Hello and welcome back to this episode of Saber Speaks, our podcast here in Sartell St. Stephen, where we try to provide information for the public, both our families and the community members, to understand all the different things that are going on in Sartell St. Stephen schools. My name is Tom Lee. I am the interim superintendent and your host for today's episode. And this is episode 2 of Special Education. And with me is Don Gent. Don, again, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Yep. And Don is our supervisor for all the special education services here. So during our first meeting, we talked a little bit about the different kinds of things that are going on in special education and how it originated and so on. And I know that sometimes people get a little frustrated with the process, right? Because sometimes the process isn't what people think it should be. So I want to talk a little bit about the process today. But before that, I mean, I think some of the people who are listening might not quite understand that there are a variety of different kinds of disabilities that we're dealing with in our public schools. I believe it's technically 13, but really 14, right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
And Don, can you help us understand what some of those are?
Yes. So there are 13, but one of the categories is split into two for 14 categories that a student can qualify for to receive special education services. So some of those are autism spectrum disorders. Students who qualify under this category can have an outside diagnosis, but we can also do a school diagnosis as well for autism spectrum disorders. We also have blind, visually impaired. We have deaf-blind. So blind, visually impaired, students can be blind, but they can also have a severity in the area of vision that qualifies them to have adaptive materials and other services for special education.
Right, correct. I think we talked about that last time. So
Yep. The
technical qualification is 20/200 in the better eye after correction, right? They might qualify for machines that would enlarge print or large print books and other kinds of things like that.
Yep.
And so that's the other point, is that each one of these categories have qualification, criteria,
yes.
Right? And so it's not like, okay, my kid's learning disabled. Well, no, we have to do some assessment to make sure they qualify
right. For
that, correct?
Correct. And those, actually, the Minnesota Department of Education website lists the criteria for each one of those areas if anyone wants to look further into each of the categories and what makes students eligible.
Yep.
So another category is deaf-blind.
Yep.
So kind of self-explanatory for that one. Deaf and hard of hearing, once again, have to have a hearing loss that is documented to impact their education.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some students, though, who wear hearing aids who are on 504s and do not receive special education services.
Is that primarily because we can't document that their hearing loss is actually negatively impacting their education? They just need some adaptations.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
We also have developmental delay, which is for students who are under the, like in preschool and up to the age of 7, they look at multiple areas for them to qualify, and they need to qualify in 2 of the areas. So it could be cognitive, academic, social, emotional, motor, and communication. Lacking on some of the others, but they need to qualify on 2.
Yep. And DD, developmentally delayed, that's a real general catch-all for preschool kids,
correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they can be developmentally delayed in lots of different areas, and we need to identify if they're going to continue in special education services. Once they turn 7, we have to give them a very specific category in which they qualify, right?
Correct.
And that's one of the differences between preschools, because I know sometimes people say, well, my kid qualified in preschool. I don't know why they're not qualifying anymore. That's because the preschool ages it's a lot easier to qualify kids in general as DD when they are 4, 5, 6 than it is to give them a specific disability category that they qualify for once they turn 7.
Yes. Another area is emotional or behavioral disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the category where students either have difficulties regulating their emotions. Students who have high anxiety may also fall under this under the area of emotional,
mm-hmm.
not the behavioral part. So we have students who will do a lot of internalizing behaviors and hold in a lot. of their emotions and might qualify under EBD. So sometimes when we think of students who are EBD, we think of the big behaviors, but not necessarily. We also have other health disabilities. This is for students who may have an outside diagnosis of ADHD, but they also have to qualify under other areas as well, in addition to the outside diagnosis. Physically impaired, those are students who have physical impairments and it's documented.
Okay, hold on for one second. I want to go back to other health impaired. Mm-hmm. That's a really broad category.
Yes.
But I think, I don't know if it was in a conversation or in our last episode, where I had an experience with a student who was a complete bubble student, right? Mm-hmm. He had no immune system, and so he couldn't come to school. So he qualified for special education services under OHI.
Yep.
Or other health impaired.
Yep.
So that's really kind of a large, so you talked about ADHD, it could be other kinds of things as well.
Right.
Right.
So it starts with an outside medical diagnosis.
Yep.
So, and then there's additional checklists that go with that outside diagnosis to determine if their outside diagnosis is impacting their education.
Yep. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry.
Well, that's all right. And then I have specific learning disability. This is where most of our students do receive special education services in Sartell. Mm-hmm. So under specific learning disability, this is where we look at if there's a discrepancy between the student's cognitive ability or their intellect and where they're performing academically. So this impacts reading, math, written language. Sometimes we'll see task management or executive functioning skills that also fall under here.
Mm-hmm.
These are students that we typically see struggling at school with academics.
Yep. And there's a range, again, yep. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There are some kids who technically qualify for SLD, or specific learning disability, in the area of written language, but not in reading and math, or math, but not in written language or reading, or reading. And so there's a, and then there are some kids who qualify for all of it.
Right.
Right? So there is a range.
We also have speech or language impairments. Those mm-hmm. are students who might qualify for articulation, or they might have a language disorder, which means they might have difficulties expressing themselves orally, being able to speak in class. They might also, though, have struggle with receptive language, understanding vocabulary, and comprehension when they're reading. They can also qualify for voice fluency, or have AUGCOM devices or augmentative communication systems.
Years ago, I had a student who was a selective mute,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think that's, he was qualified under speech for that
yes.
reason. Actually, language, because yep. for that reason, because he had issues with expressive language.
Yep, for sure. We also have traumatic brain injury. So mm-hmm. that also is an outside medical diagnosis. Sometimes this happens if we have students who have the ones that I do have are students who have been in a car accident,
yep.
Maybe have had multiple concussions, but it's usually documented through their medical provider, and then we will do an assessment at school and determine if it impacts their education.
Yep. I also had a student years ago that, you know, when he was in elementary school, he was great. He was fine. He was top of his class, great family. He got to the middle school, he was playing football, and unbeknownst to me, he had had several concussions. And he ended up being a very different student in the middle school than he was in the elementary school. And he qualified for services because of that, right?
Yep.
Multiple head injuries.
Yep.
Yep.
We also have developmental cognitive disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be called mild mentally handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
So these are students who have lower IQs. They can qualify under mild developmental, so we call it developmental cognitive disability mild, or it can be profound severe, and that really is based on their intellectual and academic testing. They can also be severely multiply impaired. These are students who may be medically fragile. They might have multiple disabilities. They might initially qualify under DCD, but as there's more impairments that we observe, that we might determine that this would be a better identifying category. I believe that's all of them
yep.
that I've covered.
And it was that DCD, the developmental cognitive disability, that is the 13th that leads
yes.
into the 14th, because
yep.
there are two levels.
Yep.
There's mild to moderate, and then there's severe.
Yes.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the process. Now, one of the things I know that sometimes staff and parents, they get frustrated with the process, but the process was put in place from the very beginning for very specific reasons. It was put in place to protect the individual rights of students because 94-142 passed in the mid-70s. One of the driving forces of that was there were a lot of Latino kids who were being assessed as mentally impaired because they were given the IQ test in English, and English wasn't their first language. And so that was an example of an abuse that the law now tries to make sure that we don't do, right? And so the process can be a little confusing for people. So let's talk a little bit about the process. So if I'm a parent and I suspect my child is struggling in school, if I suspect there's a disability, can I just call and say, hey, can I have him in special education?
Well, they can request a special education evaluation, but sometimes the best option is to really reach out to the classroom teacher, asking what their, like discussing what concerns they see at home, what are some things that school is doing to help. So one of the things that I think not all parents are aware of, that we have something at school that we call MTSS, or multi-tiered systems of support.
Yes.
And so when a student's in a general education classroom, the classroom teacher is also doing interventions with them, maybe reteaching some skills for students who have trouble understanding the concept the first time it was taught.
Mm-hmm.
But we also do universal screeners 3 times a year. We call it FastBridge in Sartell. And we look at that, and we look at students who fall below the 40th percentile. And then if we have students that fall below the 40th percentile and are still a general education student, we may refer them to a reading intervention or have some extra support in math, and we'll kind of look at that intervention and progress monitor it. And really, part of that means that they need to have these interventions for 6 to 12 weeks, and if the first one isn't working, we have teams in place at each building called a problem-solving team that really takes a look at, okay, we offered this intervention to the student, they're not making progress. Is there something else, another intervention that we could put in place to see maybe that will help promote some progress? And so then we'll do a second intervention. Sometimes that means smaller groups. So maybe they were in a group size of 4 to 5. Maybe they get some one-on-one. Maybe they get more time.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things. But really, once we arrive at the special education, which is really the tier 3 part of multi-tiered systems of support, we really need to have 2 documented evidence-based interventions that shows that we have tried other things and now we think that there may be a disability.
Okay, so and those other things takes at least 6 weeks, but most often 12 weeks.
Correct.
Correct. So if I come and my child is October 15th, I come to the school and I say, I'm worried about my child, and or if the school has some concerns on October 15th, then you're taking a look at 4 weeks is November, 8 weeks is December. Now we're looking at January. So we're really looking at, 3 months of trying these other things first.
Yep.
And that was really meant to protect the individual rights of kids, to make sure that our referrals for special ed are legitimate referrals, not just because I'm worried as a parent or because this teacher is concerned or whatever. It's really meant to protect the individual rights. So it takes 12 weeks sometimes.
Correct. And sometimes longer, because if they're making progress, so we have a lot of students who may make progress on the interventions, but it might not be at the rate we want it to be.
Correct.
Maybe they're making a slower progress. So we might keep the intervention a little bit longer, thinking they might just need that to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes after that, we still decide to do a special education eval. We also do that in the area of behavior as well. It's not just for academics. So if you have students who are struggling to attend in class or participate in class, or maybe just having trouble regulating their emotions in class, we would do interventions with them as well, documenting the same process.
So if a student goes through the entire process, and let's say there's academic concerns in math, and they go through the entire process, we've done the intervention, now there's a referral for special education. So then what happens?
So then the team would get together. The team would be made up of the parent. So we'd call the parent in, the school psychologist, a special education teacher, the administrator in the building, possibly a social worker. And then really what the team would look at is what are all the areas of concern. So if we have a student who we have to address all the areas. So you have to look at intellect, look at academics. We also need to look at communication, motor. And so if there are some concerns in communication, we might invite the speech language pathologist to the meeting. If we have some concerns in motor, we might invite the DAPE teacher to the meeting. If we have some concerns in sensory, we might invite the OT or the occupational therapist to the meeting. So it really depends on what the areas of concerns are. But that first meeting, we usually call that the assessment determination meeting. So it's where we develop the evaluation plan.
Right. And so then we have to evaluate all the different areas of concern. Mm-hmm. And then we have 30 days, correct, to complete that that evaluation. Then we have to recall the team back together and give the evaluation results.
Correct. Right?
And at that point, we either have a recommendation that your child qualifies or your child doesn't qualify, but here's what we've learned along the way. Either way, we're going to say, here's what we've learned along the way. And that's really more for a learning disability, for example, or maybe even a behavior, emotional behavior disorder student. Mm-hmm. If someone fails a vision screening, for example, then we ask the parents to take them to a doctor. And now if a doctor has a medical diagnosis of visual impairment, then that's a different story than LD or EBD. Sometimes even different than cognitive disorders like DCD, because I know that I've had some DCD kids fool me when I was a principal, right? They look like they are developing normally, but of course we've got concerns, so we take them down we start down this process, and as part of the LD evaluation, we do have the psychologist give an IQ test.
Correct.
And sometimes that IQ test comes back lower than we anticipated, and that's what, and now we've identified a different reason for this student's struggling academically. So that's a different story there.
Correct.
So there are lots of different ways of doing it. But the thing I wanted to emphasize for both parents and staff is that the process is put in place to make sure that we're not willy-nilly labeling kids one thing or another, or qualifying kids one thing or another because we want to, or because we're just trying to help, or because we're trying to do something else. We have this legal process that we must go through, right? And then once we have the evaluation
completed
and we have that meeting, that now the child either qualifies or doesn't. If they do qualify, now there's a whole nother process where we have to write an individual education plan with goals and objectives and minutes and specific individuals who are going to be named in that, and then the parent has to sign off on that plan.
Right. So initially when we have an eval results meeting, we may talk about them not qualifying. So sometimes if a student at an eval results meeting doesn't qualify for special education, we might recommend a 504.
Yep.
Because we may have identified some accommodations and modifications that we know would be successful for them.
So what is a 504 plan?
Well, a 504 plan is really, it's developed through ADA, and it's really a plan that's meant to level the playing field or give a child access to education. So really, it's not a service, it's just really what accommodations and modifications can we put in place for them to be successful in the general education classroom. And the general education teacher is the one that implements the accommodations and the modifications.
Correct. So if I'm diagnosed with ADHD and I'm distractible, easily distractible, one accommodation could be front row seat, right? So that's an example of an accommodation.
Correct.
There might be someone who struggles with note-taking, but they understand the material really well, and so they might need to get someone to share their notes with them or something like that. That's an accommodation.
Yes.
Or the teacher might give them an outline of what that lesson's going to be about.
Yes.
Right.
So then if they qualify for special education, then we would have the IEP team come together. And as part of an IEP team meeting, we need to have four core members present. We always need to have an administrator, the special education teacher of the primary disability area, and the parent, and the general education teacher. And then usually we invite additional service providers. It might be speech or DAPE or maybe another special education teacher who's providing a different academic service.
So DAPE, what does DAPE stand for? It's developmental...
Adaptive physical education. Yes.
Right, yep.
So anyway, once the team is met, they determine based on the needs identified in the evaluation report, they'll develop goals and objectives. We really look at what the student is able to achieve within a year's time, because once they're on an individual education plan, we have to review it annually. So that's how we develop the goals. We develop how we're going to measure them and how we're going to track progress. We also have service time, which really is the direct service where the special education teacher is providing the service and teaching them the skills they need. If it's an initial evaluation, we cannot start services until the parents have given us permission.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a re-eval, because once students are in special education, every 3 years we have to evaluate to determine that they still qualify or are still eligible for services under that category.
Correct. But for example, if the initial determination was made as part of a discrepancy. Well, my child's got an IQ of 120 and they're performing in the 20th percentile, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the 120 is way above average. We don't need to redo every aspect of that initial eval. Like, we don't need to redo the IQ test because, for the most part, IQ doesn't change.
Correct.
Right.
So it would really just be a file review on a re-eval.
Yep, yep.
So, but on a re-eval, so... Even once an IEP is in place after that initial one, parents have given permission for the initial. Really, we have parents, so a couple things. On an IEP, if it's a continuing IEP, if we send home parent permission, which is a prior written notice,
yep,
or a PWN, if the parents do not return the signed permission within 14 calendar days, the IEP automatically goes into effect.
Mm-hmm.
On a re-eval, or a continuing, I should say, not a re-eval, a continuing IEP.
Yep. Well, again, I think the main takeaway I would like our listening audience to understand is that there is a process. Kids mm-hmm. don't just get identified and thrown into special education services willy-nilly. And that process can take a while sometimes. And I understand that sometimes it can be a frustrating thing, but we want to make sure that we're not identifying a student with a disability
mm-hmm.
who doesn't really have a disability.
Correct.
Right? And that was part of the original intent of the law, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we had some gross examples of poor practice. And so that's the main thing. That is, it's a process. Once they are in special education, there are statutes that govern the process as far as the IEP has to be reviewed at least annually. It can
mm-hmm.
be reviewed more than annually,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, 3 months down the road when something's not working, any one of the team members can call an IEP team again.
Including the parent.
Including the parent, correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, so at least has to be reviewed annually. And then the reevaluation has to occur every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if you qualify in second grade, doesn't necessarily mean you continue to qualify because let's say the services have really made a huge difference and
mm-hmm.
now the student no longer has that discrepancy.
Mm-hmm.
So now we understand what's going on and maybe that we do exit students from services
mm-hmm.
periodically, right?
Yes, for sure.
Yep, and that's because the re-eval says they no longer need it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, sometimes people get confused about special education. What is it and how do you qualify for it? And hopefully through the course of last week's episode and this week's episode, people get a better idea. If you have questions, please don't hesitate to contact your building principal, because they're always a good source mm-hmm. there. Or you can also talk to your student's teacher as well. Mm-hmm. But Dawn, I'm sure we could go on and on and on, mm-hmm. and because yes, there's can. So much to this. But I want to thank you for helping us bring some information to the community that I think the community can helps them understand what's going on in some of our schools. But we do have a lot of kids with some identified disabilities.
Yes, right? We do. Mm-hmm.
And like, what's our, I know preschool is different, but what's our general percentage right now? Is it like 16%?
It's a little bit higher than that. I would say, well, it's about 20% in the elementary buildings and about 14 to 15 in the secondary buildings. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty high. People mm-hmm. don't quite understand that. And I think a lot of people, when they think of disability, they think of what we see, mm-hmm. right? A person in a wheelchair, a person with cerebral palsy who has a gait mm-hmm. issue, or someone who's blind or someone who's deaf. Or they don't think of all the different subtleties, and they certainly don't think of the range in each of these disabilities. So thank you for helping us clarify some of those issues. And thanks to our listening audience. That wraps our episode today. Thank you for listening in, and have a great day.